Okay, I guess I'm gonna get started without Marty. I'm gonna talk about something pretty similar to what Ryan talked about yesterday afternoon, for those of you who saw his talk. And it deals with sort of a general question relating to human demographic history. And I'll start by presenting a little bit of background about what we know of human evolution, which is not much. So, our ancestors, we know they originated somewhere in Africa, and sort of what we first think of as humans, I guess, arose a little more than 2 million years ago, probably in East Africa. And these were the first of our ancestors who used stone tools. So this is where we start seeing that they could manipulate things, and you know, there's these large sharpened rocks that they used for lots of different things. And these ancestors eventually spread out throughout parts of Eurasia, and there are fossils found in the Caucasus that are 1.6 million years old, and fossils found down in island Indonesia and in China that are somewhere between 1.5 and 1.8 million years old. And we know that these ancestors that we call Homo erectus also spread throughout much of Eurasia by 1 million years ago. So this is what we know of sort of the first colonization of our ancestors across a lot of the old world. And there's going to be a little time jump here. We also know from the fossil record that what we think of as modern humans, at least individuals whose skeletal remains are almost identical to modern humans around today, also originated probably in East Africa. And this is much more recent, maybe 150 to 200,000 years ago. And these individuals also slowly spread out. They spread out throughout sub-Saharan Africa and into the Middle East by about 100,000 years ago. And then after that, they spread throughout Europe and Asia. And eventually, we know that they spread up through Siberia, through the Bering land bridge at that time and down into the Americas no later than 15,000 years ago. So this is, roughly speaking, just about all that everyone agrees upon happened in human evolution, which is not very much. And one thing I wanted to point out is, in a simple sense, I talked about two migrations of individuals out of Africa. There was a first one happening 1 to 2 million years ago, and a more recent one on the order of 50 to 100,000 years ago. And there are these question marks here of sort of what happened when these two migrations out of Africa coincided in some sense. So there were individuals who lived in East Asia and in Europe from this earlier migration out that we don't know exactly what happened to them when more modern humans came around. And so you've all heard of Neanderthals. Neanderthals are an example of individuals who are descendants of this sort of first migration out of Africa. And we know, at least from fossil remains, that they were around at least until about 30,000 years ago in all of Europe and parts of the Middle East and Western Asia. For the untrained eye, I mean, Neanderthals looked pretty much similar to humans. They had large brains, brains about the same size as humans. To specialists, which I am not, they can point out a number of features that make a Neanderthal skull substantially different from modern human skulls. So you can kind of see there's a brow ridge here where their brow sort of juts out a lot. And the forehead is much smaller than it is in most humans. And then the back of the head is rounded in some way that modern human skulls normally aren't. There are similar individuals in East Asia. I don't know if you've heard of this fossil skull called the, often called the Hobbit. It's from some human-like creature that was roughly about 3 feet tall, 1 meter tall or so. And the fossil remains date to about 15,000 years ago. And so these individuals had brains the size of chimpanzees. They walked on 2 feet. They used stone tools. And they were around perhaps several thousand years ago. It's not clear. There's actually folk tales in Indonesia about these creatures. They tell of small, hairy, really stupid creatures, stupid by human standards, who are about 3 feet tall and lived in the forest. And there are actually a lot of stories about them that many anthropologists think were based on something, based in some way on reality, but it's not obvious whether it is or not. So the question that I want to talk about today is just what happened to those fossil groups, like Neanderthals or this Hobbit, this Homo floresiensis, and in particular, did they? I mean, so I guess there's sort of two ways of thinking about it. We know they're not around today, so either they got totally wiped out, or modern humans came in, and the two groups interbred and mixed to some degree. And if that were the case, then these groups here actually made some contribution to the modern gene pool. So the question is, if you looked at those individuals that we know only from fossils, are there individuals alive today who have those fossil groups as their ancestors? So, did these fossil groups spread their genes and have some descendants that are around today, or did they just get wiped out? So this is a question, and unfortunately, it's one that anthropology and archaeology cannot solve. What we do know is, fossils that look like these disappear from the fossil record. That's all we know. We don't know for sure exactly what happened in a genetic sense. And so one of the things that I've been interested in off and on for many years is trying to get at that question by looking just at DNA sequence variation. And that's what I'm going to talk about. And there's sort of two basic ways that you could think about doing this. One is sort of an indirect approach, and that would involve just looking at DNA of people alive today and analyzing it really carefully and trying somehow to see whether that contemporary DNA shows any evidence of these ancestral events that may have happened. So that's one approach that's somewhat indirect. And then, at least in the case of Neanderthals, there's a more direct approach. So it turns out that under the right conditions, DNA in fossils can persist for up to tens of thousands of years. And if you take many, many, many different Neanderthal fossils, very occasionally there will be some fossil that has DNA around from the original Neanderthal. And with advances in molecular biological techniques, it's now possible to get some of those DNA sequences out and compare what the Neanderthal sequence looks like to those of modern humans. And so that's a direct approach. And in some sense, when ancient DNA are available, this direct approach is much more powerful. The caveat to that is that it's very rare to get ancient DNA. People have tried to get it from many other fossils and failed. And there are some difficulties in analyzing this ancient DNA, which I guess I'll talk about. So I'll talk about that first. So also a little background. So the first thing people did was they took mitochondrial DNA and they managed to sequence parts of the mitochondrion from a bunch of different Neanderthal fossils. And they found that the Neanderthal mitochondrial DNA sequences look very different from modern human mitochondrial DNA sequences. And so they could conclude that if you look just at mitochondria, it was pretty clear that Neanderthals, that no individual alive today has sort of a Neanderthal mitochondrial haplotype. So somehow the Neanderthal mitochondrial DNA died out at some point. It turns out that even though that's the case, we can't really say whether there was some low level of admixture between modern humans and Neanderthals because of genetic drift, essentially. So that even if the two groups interbred and mixed, just by chance, if Neanderthals started as a smaller proportion of the total, like 0 to 20%, it's quite possible just by chance that those particular mitochondria died out just without any invoking any kind of special explanation. The problem from a historical perspective is that mitochondrial DNA operates as a single genetic region. It's inherited in total, and it can it only provides sort of one snapshot of history in some sense, and that snapshot can be influenced by many things, just by chance, by natural selection, you name it. So just looking at mitochondrial DNA provides only partial information, and in part because of that, and in part because technology has allowed it, individuals have also tried to sequence parts of the nuclear genome from Neanderthals. And this has been both sequencing of random regions and also targeted sequencing of particular genes. And as you may know, there's this effort to actually sequence the whole Neanderthal genome, spearheaded by Svante Paabo in Leipzig. And I don't quite know exactly how far along they are, but they're hoping to eventually get enough DNA to sequence to recover a substantial fraction of the whole genome. So this is all background. There's a problem. One problem is contamination. So you can imagine, here are these fossils. You dig them up out of the ground, and here's what they do. They dig up some bone out of the ground. They like drill into it and take a little piece out, and they grind it up and sequence whatever DNA is there. And there are many ways DNA can get in that bone. It can be there originally from 30,000 years ago. It could be from various microbes that have been sitting in the soil near the bone, or ones that have lived, ate something from the Neanderthal fossil. And it could also come from people who handled the bone. And the first Neanderthal sequencing came from the original type specimen of Neanderthals, which was a fossil found in Germany in the middle 19th century. So it had 150 years of time when anyone could pick it up and leave their little minute traces of DNA, and it can get anywhere. It can even get inside, not just right on the outside. And so there's this problem that the best they can do is sequence random DNA coming from this fossil, but they don't actually know what it is. And I'm going to talk about this a little bit more. It turns out both from some of the work that I've done and some of the work that Molly has done that a couple of these studies have been effectively debunked, I mean, shown to just be the result of contamination. And I'll talk about some of them, but it's just to give you an idea that even though in theory, the idea of taking ancient DNA and comparing it to modern human DNA seems to provide the best way of answering this kind of question. In practice, it's not so easy, and there are a lot of difficulties surrounding that. So I'm going to start by looking at two studies that were the first to sequence nuclear DNA, and these both looked at random regions. And I'll start by saying they both used the same fossil. Okay, so there's the same bone, and there are two different extracts that come out of the bone. One was sent to Eddie Rubin and his lab at the Joint Genome Institute in the Bay Area, I guess in Walnut Creek. And one was kept in Svante Paabo's lab in Leipzig. And they both went and did their stuff and got a bunch of sequence. And they analyzed them using different methods. Okay, but if you read the two papers, it looked like they were coming to completely different conclusions. And we wanted to look at this a little more carefully by taking the two data sets, using a single set of methods, and analyzing both of them, and just testing whether the two data sets were compatible with each other, which they should be since they came from the same fossil. And just to give you a sense of what kind of information you could gather, the Neanderthal sequence came in these little reeds, little fragments. And most of the reason why they're little fragments is DNA degrades over time. So you start with these whole chromosomes, and you wait, well, you actually only have to wait several years, and most of that DNA will be degraded into little pieces. And you wait longer and longer, the pieces get smaller and smaller. For this here, I mean, the pieces are on average less than 100 base pairs long. So they're just little bits here and there that they managed to identify and sequence. And the type of data that we have the Neanderthal sequence, we have the corresponding human reference sequence of, you know, the part that aligns. And there's also, you know, this huge amount of polymorphism data coming from the International HapMap. So there's independently there's, you know, roughly 4 million single nucleotide polymorphisms where there's data on frequencies of alleles in different populations, including a substantial Caucasian population. So the type of data that's informative is essentially, well, if the Neanderthal sequence is identical to the human reference sequence, you're not really getting any information. It could be anything. If it's different, then you start getting some information. And so if it's different, you can start looking at whether the Neanderthal, well, you can start looking at several things. I'm not being very clear here. Sorry. The most informative sites that people have are ones where we have polymorphism data in humans. So you can think of, for those 4 million HapMap SNPs, some of them we have Neanderthal sequence data for. And for those, you can look at whether the Neanderthal has the ancestral allele, the one that we think individuals started with, which would be the same allele that chimpanzees have, or the derived allele, the one that was caused by a new mutation. We can also look at whether the human reference sequence has that ancestral allele or derived allele. And we can also look at how frequent that derived allele is in the Caucasian sample. So let me try and draw a little picture here. Okay, so normally if you take a bunch of human sequences and you look at them, you can draw a little tree comparing what they look like, and there'd be an outgroup with chimpanzee. And there are sort of different scenarios for a Neanderthal sequence. So, okay, let me first say, that if there's a mutation, okay, which I'm putting a little dot here, that'll mean that some of the individuals here will have a derived allele, which I'll mark by a D, and the other individuals will have an ancestral allele. And we estimate that usually just by saying if whatever allele the chimp has is considered the ancestral allele. So you can imagine a situation where if Neanderthals were really totally separate and didn't interbreed with modern humans, in a cartoon version, you might expect Neanderthal sequences to be something out here. I'll talk about this more. I mean, this is kind of a simplification. And what that means, that's something that you could determine from this type of data. And what that would mean is that these types of mutations that form derived alleles in the human population would generally not include the Neanderthal. So the Neanderthal sequence here would generally not have the derived allele if they were some separate group, totally isolated and diverged from modern humans. So that's one possibility. If, on the other hand, these Neanderthal sequences were totally isolated, but then at some point they interbred and mixed, then what would happen is mutations that happened on the Neanderthal branch would show up in the modern human sample. And if they showed up in the modern human sample, those blue mutations would show up as something that's derived in a small proportion of modern humans and also derived in the Neanderthal sample. And so that would be separate from a case where if these were totally distinct and there's no little arrow here, then the Neanderthal sequence would generally not have the derived allele at the same place where these human sequences have the derived allele. So I'm just trying to give you some idea of.
Since you're saying small portion of the human sample, am I correct in assuming that it's quite subtle to decide between whether this is scenario is the case or whether they arose independently?
Yeah, I mean, in practice, in practice, here's what we do. We model this, and we model the Neanderthals as a separate population that has some degree of mixture with modern humans. And we look at the likelihood of observing any particular configuration. I mean, in practice, any particular configuration that you observe could show up from either model. It's just the different likelihoods that they would happen. I'm just trying to say intuitively, this is the kind of pattern that we're looking for, because that kind of pattern would tend to be rare under one model and tend to be more common under another. So in practice, you just take this data and.
So just elaborate a little bit on that, but you need some idea of non-recurrence of mutations, right? So presumably, if you can, from human data, estimate the likelihood of the mutation striking same site more than once, that would give you sort of background to compare
Yes.
your Neanderthal data with. So what is that number? Do you have some sense of what the probability is?
Yeah, it's pretty rare. So just to give you a rough sense, if you look at a human sequence and a chimpanzee sequence, they differ. The divergence between them is about 1.3%. And humans and chimpanzees are thought to have 10 times more divergence than humans and Neanderthals. So we're talking less, well, on the order of 1/10 of a percent. probability that you would have multiple mutations at the same nucleotide site. It's something that you can incorporate in the model pretty easily, but it's a pretty small amount.
Can I add another question?
Sure.
You were talking here about this recurrent interbreeding, so assuming that for a while they didn't. My question, are you also considering scenarios where they interbred for a while and then it faded out?
No.
I guess you can't have any scenarios, just like for population, for bottlenecks or something. So what is the subset of scenarios that you're looking at?
So we're actually looking at a scenario where Neanderthals branched off and were totally isolated for some long period of time and only mixed with modern humans recently. And there's a reason why we consider that model. So if you look at the fossil records, what we see is that there are these individuals, there's sort of different names that they go under, that colonized Europe about 1 million years ago. And you look at their fossil remains, and they just, over time, if you look at the time series, they seem to just take their own path compared with fossil remains throughout the rest of the world. And so these sort of Neanderthals that we know them as are labeled as such based on these particular skeletal characteristics that show up there and nowhere else. And the common wisdom, well, I'm not saying that's true, I'm just saying the common wisdom is that that only could arise if those groups of individuals were isolated and not sort of interbreeding or migrating much with these other neighboring groups that had different skeletal characteristics. And so what we see is that sort of Neanderthal-like skeletal characteristics, they start several hundred thousand years ago, they become stronger and stronger and stronger over time, and then in the fossil record, those individuals totally disappear somewhere between 25,000 and 30,000 years ago. So that those types of, you know, skulls with that particular rounded back and you know, the long brow ridges, and there's something different in the inner ear and all these other little things, we don't see those features anymore, except for a couple of very rare exceptions. And so the model, at least as phrased by anthropologists, is that this is a sign of complete isolation followed by maybe getting wiped out, or maybe, you know, some low level of interbreeding. Yes, Guy.
How much of an issue, well, unless you're going to talk about it, how much of an issue is shared ancestral polymorphism between Neanderthals and humans?
It is an issue. It's accounted for in the model. So essentially, that shared ancestral polymorphism is what makes it harder to distinguish anything from a particular nucleotide site. So the basic idea of what we're going to do is just take all the data, start with this simple model.
The simple
model being roughly this, just having a single sort of main population that leads to modern humans, a single branching of these Neanderthals that is completely isolated, and possible mixing of the two very recently. So we have a model, and one of the parameters in that model is the amount of contribution these Neanderthals have to the modern human gene pool. We take all the data, we use a likelihood framework, and try to see how likely the data are under different parameter values, essentially. Thought to occur roughly between 45,000 and 30,000 years ago in a sort of rolling wave. The two were thought to be contemporaneous in far eastern Europe, maybe about 45,000 years ago, and contemporaneous in the Iberian Peninsula as recently as 30,000 years ago.
So there the question marks are on the plot. So you have like a family of models saying one of the parameters is this flux.
Mm-hmm.
And then you estimate a maximum likelihood for that flux. Because for very low flux, probably then the two models would be very, very similar.
Yes.
And so.
So yes, it's just a maximum likelihood of that flux. And the thing that I want to mention is, so the way the likelihood calculations are done, they actually assume that each of these informative sites are independent from each other. And informative means one where there's polymorphism data in humans and the Neanderthal sequence. And in reality, these sites are very far, they're very dispersed throughout the genome, and so they are essentially independent. And that means that this composite likelihood is essentially really like a true likelihood. And what that means is we have reason to believe that that estimates of uncertainty in the frequentist sense are accurate. So we can quantify to some extent to what, you know, how certain we are of certain estimates that we make and you know, get approximate confidence intervals for them. Yes, Guy.
Can you give some intuition as to what type of signal would differentiate ancestral polymorphism and the low rate of migration below? I understand that you apply the likelihood, but I'm just wondering, you know, what in the data would discern between the two, if there's a simple intuition about that?
I'm not sure if I can answer that easily. Let me say this, that this type of pattern could presumably be due to some ancestral polymorphism or due to recent mixing. And in a simplistic sense, the more of these you observe, if you observe more of these than you would expect just based on ancestral polymorphism, then under this modeling scenario, it has to be caused in part by Neanderthal mixing coming in. So it's more just a sense that we have these particular patterns that we think could arise by one method or the other, and we run a bunch of simulations to account for the distribution of how much you would expect under some kind of null model where you don't have any of this mixing, and any additional amount essentially would have to be due to something. In our model, it would have to be due to this mixing.
I was just wondering how would you go about setting the current and the current sizes relative to the ancestral size?
Totally arbitrarily.
Okay. No, it's there.
I mean, in my defense, I'm only just taking a method that was already published, okay? And I'm just applying it uniformly, and you can argue about the specifics of the model.
No, I just wanted to be clear whether the ancestral size was something that was being estimated as well, or whatever.
No. Okay. Shamil.
Yeah. So my understanding is that Neanderthal remains are only found in Europe and Asia. So why African population wouldn't serve as a control for ancient admixture versus interbreeding? So if we assume that Africans had no chance to meet Neanderthal. Because you have only one human population in this picture.
Yes. So I have one human population because it's easier to model and because that's what people did before. The argument for doing that is that we actually don't know to what extent modern human migration happened between, let's say, 30,000 years ago and now. And there is a possibility, I'm not saying how likely it is, that ancient Europeans and Neanderthals interbred, and then those Neanderthal genes migrated back to Africa sometime in the last 30,000 years. It's a possibility that, you know, is there. Yes, Molly.
But if you had actual genome data, not just these little fragments, then presumably there'd be information about the length of the haplotypes that was, in distinguishing between ancestral polymorphism and recent migration, wouldn't the size of the chunks be informative?
Yes.
So presumably we can do better with assuming that they actually get Neanderthal and not.
But you also said that they're very dispersed, so.
If you get the whole genome, so each fragment may be 100 base pairs, but their idea is they grind up the whole bone and they get enough DNA to actually get 1x coverage for the whole genome. That's their idea. I'm not sure that it's going to happen.
Wouldn't the sort of the geographical separation of the modern humans give you additional information on the fate of these common derived alleles? Say, for example, if you have the same derived allele in Neanderthal and Polynesians, would you count this as evidence for or against Model A?
Well, I mean, that could arise either by chance, the same mutation arising twice, or by Neanderthals had mixing with modern humans in Europe and those individuals migrating to Polynesia. I'm pretty sure that latter scenario becomes more likely under most models. So roughly speaking, I think any time Neanderthals show up with the derived allele, it's kind of a sign that there's been admixture. It's more likely under models of admixture than it is under anything else. Just because in the end, it's still always too unlikely to have multiple mutations at the same site.
Stepping back for sort of an ignorant biology question, is it known whether there were any, or what the possibility is that there were chromosomal rearrangements between Neanderthals and humans that would make it difficult biologically to interbreed? What the chances of that?
It's not known. I can say, based on other systems, that it's extremely unlikely that major chromosomal rearrangements would prevent any, I mean, would serve as a barrier to interbreeding. Certainly there are segregating inversions and translocations in many primate species. So it can happen. It's an open question, but I don't think. Well, I will speculate one thing, or something that's already been speculated. There happens to be this, well, some people know this better than I do, so if you know it better than I do and I make a mistake, then correct me. There's this inversion found in European Americans, or in Europeans, that's at reasonable frequency and seems to be very old. I think there is some group from Decode Genetics that found this. And there was some speculation that particular, so the inversion itself is old and is segregating in natural populations. And there's a speculation that it actually could have been inherited by, you know, from some archaic human group such as Neanderthals. And that would help explain how it could be so old and persist in the population. It'd be one possible explanation. Anyway. Okay, so the basic summary is we take this way of analyzing the data, and we use it to analyze these two data sets, and we estimate three things. One is the average divergence time between a single modern human sequence and a single Neanderthal sequence. One is an estimate of when the actual population split from each other. So this number is always going to be less than the number on top. And then there's this parameter here of what contribution Neanderthals made to the modern gene pool. So the only point is there's a single method used on two different samples from the same bone. And this is what we get. And as you can tell when you look at the last two lines, like there's clearly some discrepancy here. I want to say that, like, everything we know gives us a prior belief as to which of these is true. Because if you look at this carefully, what it's saying is all modern Europeans are Neanderthals, essentially. And very few people believe that. Yeah, I mean, I know all of us think we know a Neanderthal. That's not exactly the same thing. So you can actually, so we have this, so you look at that and you know, okay, at least one study is wrong. It could be both studies are wrong, but at least one of them is wrong because they're not internally consistent. And you can look at things in other ways that kind of reinforce which one is wrong. And one of those is to look at sort of how much human-specific divergence there is. So if you think, you have, suppose now you just take three sequences. The Neanderthal sequence, you've got the human reference sequence that aligns to it, and the outgroup of chimpanzee. And we're going to look at how many mutations are on this branch. And we concentrate on this here because the Neanderthal-specific branch is actually very difficult to study. And that's because of postmortem DNA damage causes there to be many changes in the DNA that are not reflective of what the original Neanderthal sequence was 30 or 40,000 years ago. So, some Neanderthal dies, and the bones are sitting there. They get bombarded by X-rays. It breaks up the DNA, but not only does it break up the DNA, it chemically changes some of the bases so that when we try to read it now, we mess up. And to some extent, people think they know most of what happens that we mess up on, but it's pretty hard to figure out. And roughly speaking, if you have low coverage ancient DNA data, it's very, very hard to figure out what's real and what isn't in terms of mutations that would have happened on this branch. We know statistically, most of the time when you observe this particular transition, it's probably fake, but we don't actually know. The only way that you would know to some real certainty is if you can get high coverage of a particular DNA sequence. So whatever happens, whatever damage happens is happening independently across different copies of chromosomes in different cells. So in theory, if you have enough DNA, you sequence all of it, and you sequence the same region over and over and over again. And if you sequence it 50 times, maybe occasionally there's going to be this damage that causes a change, but there's sort of be a consensus sequence that would reflect the original base pair that was there. We're not at the point where we have that much DNA, so all this data is based on single coverage, and so that's why we have to kind of ignore this branch. Okay, so if you just look at the number of mutations that happen per kilobase of sequence, there's a difference. Okay, it's not clear whether that's statistically significant, but there's an interesting pattern when you look at the one problematic study, the one that came from Svante Paabo's lab, this Green et al. Paper. And that problem is this. If you take the data and you break it up into based on how large the fragments of DNA sequenced were, you get this pattern where the small fragments have more divergence than the large fragments. And this is problematic because of this. Like if you believe that, so if you take some piece of DNA and you sequence it, and it's from this small fragment, that's consistent with it being Neanderthal DNA. You know that over time, the fragment size of this actual Neanderthal DNA gets smaller and smaller. If you had recent modern human contamination, that contamination is more likely to be a larger fragment, a larger piece of DNA. There's sort of less that's happened to it that it would get broken up into a small piece. And so the pattern that you would expect to observe from modern human contamination is exactly this. Okay, you'd expect that these large fragments are looking different from the small fragments. And in fact, if you just sort of did the same thing comparing two different human sequences instead of a human and a Neanderthal sequence, this is sort of the range of the number of mutations you'd expect per kilobase. And what you can see is, especially if you look at these large fragments, they're right within the range of what you would expect if it were just modern human DNA. Okay, and even the median fragments are sort of on that edge. And so our suspicion, and this is something that the authors of the paper actually knew beforehand, is that most of the large fragments sequenced are actually modern human contaminants. There actually is some Neanderthal DNA, and those are primarily the smaller fragments, the shorter ones that they had. So there's another way you can look at this. You know, I was talking about looking at whenever the Neanderthal here had the derived allele. And if you just run simulations, it turns out the under whatever model you want to assume, however you set whatever other parameters of your model, that the more contribution Neanderthals made to the modern human gene pool, the more mixing there was, the more likely you expect the Neanderthal to have the derived allele. Okay, so this is just looking at all these polymorphisms and just counting up the proportion of time that the Neanderthal has this derived allele. We don't know what all these other parameters are very accurately, but we do know that there's always these monotonically increasing functions, that the more mixing you have, the higher this proportion is. And so here's what you get if you compare, you know, this one study from Eddie Rubin's lab, the study from Svante Paabo's lab, break things up according to size of fragment, and look at sort of what you would expect if it were complete contamination, if it were just a human reference sequence. And you sort of get the same thing, where there's a pattern where the small fragments look different from the large fragments. And the problem is there's really not an easy way of explaining that kind of size bias without having contamination. So, you know, the main conclusion is just that contamination is a major problem and seems to be a pretty large issue with this particular study. So, anyway, yeah. I guess I've got one other thing to talk about. I can either talk now or take a break now. I don't know what people prefer. Coffee break. Okay, I'm going to start up on the other way of getting at this question, indirectly. And this will be much more related to what Ryan talked about. And so the basic structure of what we try to do is, so we start with data, and this data consists of resequencing data. So data where you've sequenced each individual in some multiple human populations. And the basic idea is to have some kind of model-based framework and estimate model parameters. And the challenge of doing this is finding the appropriate model, because roughly speaking, you can view the possible isolation and mixture of some group like Neanderthals as a form of population structure. So it's an example of something that we know is happening in human populations. Not everyone is the same. And people aren't the same because there's not random mating among all individuals. There are groups of people, and those groups of people tend to stay in one place. And so there's not a free flow of genes across the whole world. And because of that, you have to have some way of accounting for the population structure that we know exists. This is not easy. And only after accounting for all of that, try and look for any additional population structure that would be caused by some group like Neanderthals. And so what we're going to do, I'm going to describe an archaic method for using frequency spectrum data, not as elegant as what Ryan did, to estimate demographic parameters. And then we're going to use linkage disequilibrium, and some way to try and get at whether there's some additional aspect of population structure not accounted for in the model. So that's the basic idea. So wait, this model's too simple. Okay. So I first want to try and give a little intuition as to why this kind of approach could be successful. Okay, so it's roughly the same idea as something used in human genetics called admixture mapping. So you can imagine, let's say 30 or 40,000 years ago, modern humans and Neanderthals come into contact, and they interbreed. And since they've been isolated for a long time, their genomes look different. If we were to sample it then, you know, there'd be lots of differences, and it'd be clear what you have. So after one generation, as an F1, you'd have hybrid individuals. They would inherit half of their chromosomes from a Neanderthal parent and half from a modern human parent. And if those F1 individuals bred and formed in F2, well, you'd have something like this. You'd have a mosaic where their chromosomes would be partly inherited from modern human grandparents and partly inherited from Neanderthal grandparents. And if we were able to look at the genome here, it would be totally obvious what you're observing. Okay, the black and red would be easily distinguishable, and these chunks of, you know, these chunks of ancestry would be, you know, large fractions of a chromosome, so it would be very easy. We're not in that state. I mean, we're many, 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 you know, on the order of, let's say, 1 to 2,000 generations later. Okay, so you can imagine 1 to 2,000 generations of mating and recombination happening, which would mean that if there were this mixture, then what we would expect to observe at the present are chromosomes that are these mosaics, except there would actually be, you know, hundreds or thousands of these little pieces across each chromosome. So, you know, in an ideal world, somehow we'd be able to identify what looks black and what looks red. You know, what part looks like Neanderthal and what part looks not like Neanderthal. Just a rough, you know, back of the envelope calculation as to how long these sort of red segments of Neanderthal ancestry would be, on average they would be 50, 60 kb long. If this admixture happened, let's say 1500 generations ago or 2000 generations ago. So they'd be pretty long. So the point is, if you had enough data, the goal is, do you have some way of, if you sequence, in an ideal world, you sequence the whole genome of many, many individuals. And then the goal would be, can you identify stretches of DNA on the order of tens of kb long that look different? Okay, and the time scale matters a lot here, because if this mixing happened 100,000 years ago or too far back in the past, then the size of these little fragments would be too small, and you just would never be able to figure them out. If they were only like 1 or 2 kb long, it would just look, I mean, it would just look like normal DNA. It'd be too short for you to actually tell that something's different. Yes, Shamil.
So if you're saying they are 50 kb long, it means that individually they wouldn't stand out from the picture of normal human LG, right? Because Bruce Lund presented this work when they simulated introduction of very long haplotype responsible for our intelligence from Neanderthals. And my understanding was that their simulation produced very long, unusually long haplotype, what they claimed. And what you're saying, they are not, at least individually, unusually long, right?
It depends on how you look at it. So I'm arguing that the scale that we're looking at is tens of kb. And now within tens of kb, you can have unusual haplotype structure. And that's sort of what we try to do. But I would argue that, like, getting something that's much longer than that is not going to be something that comes from Neanderthals.
But even if they're not unusually long, they're unusually diverged, right? right? You're not just looking for long things in this context. You're looking for long things that carry more differences.
Yes. So that's sort of the key thing.
I'm just curious how to reconcile your simulation and
response. Diplomatically avoiding the answer.
Moving right along. Okay, let me try and give some more intuition for what we're looking at. And this is where things get kind of vague, because once we deal with linkage disequilibrium, like, things get hard. And so I just want to give a little more intuition for what kinds of things you might expect to look for in actual data that could be caused by something like this. So I'm going to start with, you know, a really simple situation. Suppose you have modern humans and some really diverged archaic human group that mixes. And in the ideal world, you would have a sample observed at the present where some individuals sort of had modern human copies of it, and some individuals would have these archaic human copies. And I just want to point out that the main difference between this and a situation where, let's say, everyone inherited some modern human copy of DNA is mostly in this time period here, you would have a single long branch separating the two. This is kind of a caricature. It's not ever really this easy. But in an ideal world, this is what you have. You'd have a single long branch that would separate these two groups, and that branch would be on average longer than the type of branch that you would have if all individuals had modern human ancestry. Okay, so the problem, of course, is there's many problems, but let me start by saying two obvious ones. We never know the tree. We're not given that. We're just given sequence data. And not only that, it turns out that when you look along a chromosome, this tree is always changing. So recombination causes the tree to actually change. So it's not even that we're going to figure out what the tree is from data, because there's actually thousands of trees. So just keep that in the back of your mind so that there's some difficulties. But in an ideal world, we'd actually know what these trees are, and they'd be different. And we'd be able to, I'm going to argue that there's some aspect of the way those trees are different that would let us estimate some parameter that I'm going to call C, which would be the contribution of archaic humans to the modern human gene pool. And here's the basic idea. So take this tree again with some weird individuals, you know, these weird archaic human individuals, and assume, you know, you put mutations on this tree like we normally do. And because these individuals are weird, there are going to be a lot of mutations that happen on this one long branch, and those mutations are going to separate these two groups. So you can take this tree, and it would correspond to sequence data. So suppose you take, you know, a bunch of individuals, you sequence them, and these are just their segregating sites. And it turns out, well, so this sequence data corresponds exactly to the picture of the tree that I showed earlier. And what's unusual about it is you've got a whole bunch of sites, all the ones that are shaded in red here, that are in complete linkage disequilibrium. That when you think of them as partitioning your sample into two groups, they're partitioning it in identical ways. Another equivalent way of saying that is that if you calculate something like R squared, the R squared value is 1. They're completely correlated. However you want to phrase it. If all these mutations came from the same tree, the interpretation of it would be that all of them happened on the same branch of that tree. And the basic idea is, if you take real data and you look for patterns like this, these patterns are going to be more common in situations where you have this ancient admixture than if you don't. Okay, so that's the basic intuition. I don't really know a good way of implementing this. What we actually do is we take a data set, and we scan across all possible subsets of the segregating sites, and we calculate a score function based on that, which tries to encapsulate two things. It tries to encapsulate observing sites like this, okay, how many of them you would observe, how far apart they are, and it also incorporates the fact that when you're actually looking at real sequence, when you actually have recombination, you're not really going to expect to observe, even in the ideal world, you're not going to expect to observe these complete correlation between sites. Sometimes it'll be almost completely correlated and differ by a little bit. So what we did is we developed a completely arbitrary way of trying to summarize that, that looks at pairs of sites that are very closely, very closely correlated, and trying to quantify in a single number sort of how much of that we observe. So I'm not arguing that there's anything intelligent about this as much as we're just trying to find some way of measuring the basic idea of what I said. And then we have something that we can quantify. So here's an example of a gene. I don't know if you've seen data in this format. Each row is an individual. Each column is a segregating site. The different colors represent different genotypes. Blue, yellow, and red are the three different genotypes. Gray is missing data. And so what we do is we take data like this, and we scan across all subsets, and we come up with a certain subset corresponding to these particular sites outlined. And if you squint really hard and stare at it, it turns out like all of these sites are in really strong linkage disequilibrium with each other. And they're also really spread out. And our sort of idea is, well, let's have something like this and try and measure this in actual data and measure it in simulated data. So this is the basic structure of what we're trying to do. And the more specific thing that we do is, oh wait, before I talk about the more specific thing, I'll just say, if you run simulations, you can show that like this particular thing that we're looking at is very sensitive to the presence of ancient and mixture. I don't know, the distributions are different. So now I'm going to talk about null model, a null model that we start with. And this is more realistic than the simple one that I showed earlier, maybe not as parameter rich as the one or some of those that Ryan looked at yesterday. But this is a two-population model. The model's one African population, one non-African population, and there's some kind of time that they diverge, some kind of migration rate between them that's not listed here, some population growth and a population bottleneck. All these are different aspects of the data that people have thought may exist, or aspects of the recent population history that people thought may exist. And so we took data, actually the same data that Ryan did, from the Environmental Genome Project. And we took that data and we parsed it in various ways. And there's a sample of West Africans, Yoruba, and also a sample of individuals of European ancestry. We took that data and we use sort of a summary likelihood approach. So we summarize the data by various summaries that are all included within the joint frequency spectrum. So that would include numbers of segregating sites in different populations and the pi and Tajima's D and FST, the simple ways that people use of summarizing data. And we then just had a mostly a brute force coalescent based way of estimating the likelihood of the data under different model parameters. And so we use some kind of iterative grid search where we sort of hone in on whatever, on on what parameter combinations are most likely under the specific way that we summarize our data. And the goal is to come up with a model that accounts for recent population history, recent splitting of populations, and whatever, that doesn't involve this ancient admixture with some archaic group for the moment. So here's, for example, what we get. You know, we estimate a bunch of parameters. They're comparable to parameters that people estimate by methods. And the goal of this is try and make sure that this model is plausible to start with. There are different ways of doing this. You can kind of essentially see how well the data fit the model by saying, well, if we simulated data under this best fit model, does it look as close to the parameter values as the actual data did? I don't know. I wouldn't say it's ideal. But to the extent that we can, the model seems to accurately reproduce patterns of data. And this is true both for the particular parameters used in the fitting process, which you would expect, and it also fits other aspects of the data that were not used in the model fitting process. So in particular, it does predict overall levels of linkage disequilibrium as measured by sequence-based estimates of the recombination parameter rho. So that, in some sense, gives us some confidence that this model is somewhat appropriate. And it turns out that correcting for overall levels of LD is something that's important for the analysis. And it's important because the kind of structure of the argument is kind of a little convoluted here, is we're saying, okay, we've taken this data, we've estimated a model, and that model can predict overall levels of linkage disequilibrium. Does it also predict linkage disequilibrium as quantified by that particular ad hoc summary S star that I talked about earlier? So this is viewing it as, well, we have a model and it seems to fit, but does it also fit in terms of something specifically constructed to try and distinguish between ancient admixture and not? And the way you can do that, you can we just use a simple simulation-based way. We simulate data comparable to the actual data, mimicking, you know, the particular region sequenced and the population history as we estimated, and something about recombination rates that vary. And we just sort of tabulate, well, how often do we get from our simulations values of this S star that are more unusual than what we observe in the actual data. Okay, and so we can get a p-value, a simple p-value for each locus, assuming that our null model is correct. And we then, these regions are essentially evolutionarily independent of each other. So you get a distribution of p-values. I can show it using a QQ plot. This is, don't really look very carefully here. This is an old figure, and all these p-values changed. So all I want to say is you can get a distribution of p-values, and we combine them by using, I think it's a standard method. If you take, what is it? The sum of 2 times the log of the p-values, it is chi-square distributed with 2n degrees of freedom or something. So you get, there's a way of combining all these p-values into sort of a global p-value. And we get something that's significant. Well, significant by scientific terms in terms of it being less than 5%. It's not overwhelmingly significant. If you did the same thing in the West African population and do the same kind of analysis, we get a much more significant value. So what that means is we start, I mean, I guess the way I would interpret it as is we start with some demographic model that tries to incorporate what we know about recent population history. And now we have a way of showing that the model doesn't fit well. It doesn't fit when you look at this particular thing, this particular S star. And the, you know, as much as I'm willing to argue is just that one possible explanation for what we observe is the thing that everyone is interested in, which is this, you know, maybe admixture with Neanderthals or with those little hobbit people or something. But there are actually sort of other explanations. And what I want to try and point out is, for some group like Neanderthals, we have this prior hypothesis that maybe they mixed or not. But we actually don't know. I mean, the fossil record is somewhat limited. You know, it depends on how much effort people spend going out looking for bones. It depends on lots of things beyond our control of how well fossils are actually preserved. There are huge parts of the world where fossils are not preserved at all. Anywhere where it's hot and humid, nothing survives. So it's very hard to ever get, you know, fossils from like tropical rainforest, for example. I mean, it essentially is impossible. But what I want to point out is what we're looking at is this indirect thing, and I view it as trying to look for signs of unaccounted for population structure that possibly is very old. But you can't tie that to specific fossil groups. We don't actually know, you know, if you believed that this p-value found when analyzing the European data shows something about ancient admixture, you don't actually know it deals with Neanderthals. That's a separate inquiry altogether. And sort of to highlight that, the stronger evidence of some kind of admixture is happening from this population in West Africa, and we have no prior hypothesis of admixture there.
I have two obvious questions. So one is, you have obviously some population structure within Europe and within Africa, and how this, and also you, as Ryan told us yesterday, migration rates between the human populations can significantly change the model. So how this can play into this? And second question is, what would be your maximum likelihood estimate of the flux? So what is it like 0.5% of a mixture, or is it like 15% of a mixture?
I'll answer the second question in the next slide. The first question, every model is arbitrary. I suspect that population structure within Europeans is not an issue. We know the extent of it, and it's pretty small. Okay, we don't know the extent of population structure within sub-Saharan Africa. Because sub-Saharan African groups are very undersampled. You know, we have some guesses from SNP data, but there's no published sequence data from multiple human populations from sub-Saharan Africa. And so that poses a problem. I mean, it's just kind of, it's unknown whether that is actually what we observe here. I have some unpublished data that suggests that there's actually something else going on. So, you know, if we model population structure between, let's say, Bantu speakers and pygmies from the Central African Republic, it doesn't account for this. But there could be something else going on. I mean, I think it's just one of those things where Africa is understudied, both in terms of people looking for fossils that are recent, and also ability to recover those fossils, because there's huge swaths that are impossible to get fossils from. So I don't know. I mean, my only sense is I'm pretty sure that we can account for population structure outside of Africa. Within Africa, we don't know. I'm guessing that there's still something else going on. It turns out when you do look at the spotty fossil record within Africa, it's a huge mess. There are all these different groups, I mean, that all show greater differences in their fossil morphology than between modern humans and Neanderthals. And we just sort of classify them as one group because people don't care as much because most researchers are not from sub-Saharan Africa, so they don't care as much. And so in the end, no one really knows. I mean, we know there's a lot of diversity. We know there are all these little groups. We don't know if they're different species or subspecies or isolated or not, and when they're moving from one place or another. But we know that there's every possibility that there was some group that was isolated for a while and then kind of mixed. And what I guess I'd argue is that it very well may be the case that throughout human history, there's been a pattern of groups becoming isolated and then mixing, and then becoming isolated and mixing. And it doesn't have to be for as long a time as Neanderthals being isolated for several hundred thousand years and then mixing. It could just be tens of thousands of years, but it could be a repeated thing where groups of people had not this continuous migration pattern, but this discontinuous one where there are periods of isolation, and then maybe the climate changes, and then all of a sudden they mix again. You know, things like, you know, the Sahara Desert, sometimes it's there and sometimes it's gone, depending on how climate changes. And either it's a huge barrier to gene flow, or it's not at all. So that's what I would argue as a general thing. So if you were to actually estimate the amount of admixture of gene flow of this archaic group, we can do that just viewing it as another parameter in the model and using the same likelihood framework and estimating it and looking at this the profile likelihood curve. And so if you do that, you estimate around 10% and a 95% confidence interval of 5 to 15%. And what I will say is, since the method that we're using for estimating likelihoods is computationally intensive, it's reasonably difficult to estimate how accurate something like this is going to be. So we've done, kind of laughable, we've done 6 simulations of simulated data and gone and estimated parameters for those simulations. And I can say that the approximate 95% confidence intervals, their coverage properties are roughly 95%, which is what you would expect based on 6 replicates. But there's 7 parameters in the model, so you have like 42 comparisons. And out of those 42, the 95% confidence interval covers the true value 40 out of 42 times, which is right on 95%. So obviously you would want to do more, but I mean without a better simulation scheme, it's kind of hard to do too many more. Yes, Guy.
Okay, I don't know if this is when you do the parameter with the specifically Neanderthal thing. Mm-hmm. Do you estimate, you know, parameters such as?
No. How let me already answer. No.
It's a weird question. I don't know. Maybe, in a sense, you answered it. So one is, do you estimate parameters such as when was the original split and when was the original mixing? Because that could, you know,
yes.
Maybe that could, you know, hone you on
yes.
Something more specific. I don't know.
That's true. We don't. We assume it to be a split from 400,000 years ago to 50,000 years ago. And the basic reason is if you use brute force coalescent simulations to estimate likelihoods, then there's this challenge of only being able to estimate so many parameters at a time. And the limit, as far as my patience, is 7 parameters. So that I do agree that in theory, if you had a good enough method that was quick enough, it would be interesting to be able to estimate these times as well. I kind of feel like the method that we're doing now is not really appropriate, in the sense that there's not enough. I don't think there's enough information in there, and there's not enough computational power that I have access to really explore it.
Those are parameters for which we actually have reasonable independent information, as opposed to most of the other parameters.
That is correct.
Yeah, so it's unlikely to be wrong by some huge amount.
No, but if you enter these as parameters and then you get them out, then it's going to become more likely that it's Neanderthals rather than...
than something else. Now, that's certainly true. I'd like to be able to do that, and possibly by using Ryan's methodology, maybe possible. So Molly pointed out a good point. We do have prior information about the Neanderthal split, and that's why I took these values. We have prior information about possible mixture in East Asia. And that's because we know that, from the very first slides, we know that Homo erectus left Africa somewhere between 1.5 and 2 million years ago, and then they seem to be isolated over in East Asia pretty much for all of that time, and the recent mixing would have happened only whenever modern humans came in, roughly 50,000 years ago. So we have some sense there as well. And so you can go and estimate how much admixture there would have been in Asia with some group like Homo erectus or Homo floresiensis. And we estimate some amount on the order of 1 or 2%. And the only thing I'd say is we do estimate something that's greater than zero. And so the likelihood whenever you get to the zero part is really low. And to the extent I'm willing to believe anything, I believe that there's still something unaccounted for in the model, some other aspect of population structure that could be, among other things, this kind of admixture. And I think you could probably actually get at this if you looked at the data more closely, because if it really were Homo erectus admixture, you're looking at DNA that would be very, very diverged. I mean, it would be outside the realm of normal human genetic variation. The only problem is that it'd be very rare. So admixture rates of 1% mean the vast majority of regions you're looking at have no evidence of that kind of ancestry. But then you would occasionally stumble across some region where things look weird, and they look weird especially in East Asian samples. So if you look across the whole genome and you look at levels of diversity, there's much more diversity in sub-Saharan African populations than any non-African population. If this admixture were true, then I'm arguing you would be able to observe pretty large chunks, as large as 50 kb, that would have a tremendous amount of diversity within your East Asian samples. And not only would it have a lot of diversity, it would have that weird pattern of linkage disequilibrium where you'd have a lot of sites in there that have very strong LD.
So if you have since it's going to involve, in this case, do you have a catalog of what regions of the genome those are?
No.
But you could, right?
In theory, you could. In practice, I'm not sure I really believe this. Because I've just argued that I think I know what the pattern would look like. And then if you go back to the data and actually look for that pattern, you don't see it.
Okay, that's what I was
wondering. You don't see it as often as I think you should. So I can point to the literature, and there's maybe a couple regions that look like this that people have published papers on. And I can look at the 222 genes and point to maybe two of them that look like that. But it's actually something that should show up much more than 1% of the time. So suppose you had 1% admixture. That doesn't mean that you have 99% of the genes that look normal and 1% that looks weird. It means that at roughly 90% of the loci, things look normal. At 10% of the loci, 10% of the samples within that locus look weird. So the idea is conditional on admixture happening 50,000 years ago, and those admixed genes surviving to the present, they will increase in frequency, and they should show up in your sample roughly 10% of the time. So when you kind of do the rough calculation, we should, if this were really true, we should be finding 20 genes, roughly on average, where there's some evidence of this deep admixture and it's showing up in East Asians as opposed to anywhere else. We don't find that, okay? So all I could say is, well, yeah, we do our method, we can estimate a parameter and we seem to exclude zero, but there's a clear confounding factor that any other population structure not accounted for in the model is a confounding factor in here. And I guess my suspicion at the moment is one of those confounding factors is really what's going on. And because in this case, when you're dealing with something that's that different, it should just be obvious by any analysis. You should just stare at the data and say, look, you know, that's a different species kind of thing.
Right. And what I was getting at was I was wondering if you could point to regions in the genome and just say that.
Well, for whatever it's worth, you can point to a couple regions that look like that. But that's not enough. I mean, not enough for this model, at least. Okay, I guess I'm essentially done. I want to emphasize...
Would that thing be very different than balanced polymorphism?
Well, it would have to be balanced and segregating in East Asia and not segregating outside of Asia. Kind of weird. Possible, but weird. I mean, you know, you also could distinguish between them if you had enough data by, you know, at least classically, if you have a balanced polymorphism, there's a sort of a decay of its effects surrounding the actual balanced polymorphism caused by recombination.
In here, there shouldn't be a decay.
Yeah, it should be actually that there's a discrete piece of DNA that was inherited. And so there shouldn't be a difference in the middle of it versus the edges of it.
I see. So balanced polymorphism, there would be, you know, a certain center somehow.
Yeah, there would be sort of, like, if you were looking at, let's say, polymorphism in East Asia, you'd get some bell curve on average. And on average, according to this kind of model, if you're actually getting introgression, it would just be some region that's much higher. And I think in theory you'd be able to distinguish between them if you had full sequencing data. So I guess the only thing I want to emphasize from this sort of indirect study of possible admixture are two things. One is, you know, the pluses and minuses of doing this. One minus is you can't tie anything to specific groups. You can't say anything about Neanderthal admixture because we're not studying Neanderthals, we're just studying modern humans. So that's a drawback. But the positive aspect is if you're looking at, let's say, admixture in East Asia, well, you can't do it using fossils because no one has successfully gotten any DNA out of any of the fossils there. And chances are very unlikely that they will because preservation sucks in that area. It's too wet, it's too humid. So DNA degrades too fast, and I think it's really unlikely they're ever going to get any amount of DNA out of those fossils. So the positive thing is you can address questions that you can't address otherwise in areas of the world like East Asia or in sub-Saharan Africa. And I guess the other thing that I want to speculate is, you know, so we've done this analysis with these three populations, and we seem to find evidence of some kind of additional structure happening in all three of them. And, you know, the more populations you study and you start finding the same thing, then you start thinking that it's not actually something dealing with Neanderthals, let's say. And maybe it actually is reflecting something about population history that we don't know about. So I'm going to argue, you know, under the standard model of population history, all modern humans came from Africa very recently. But it's possible that whatever group left Africa, they came from some kind of structured population. So there could have been population structure within Africa on the order of 50,000 to 500,000 years ago. And that kind of population structure is not accounted for in any of our models. And that kind of thing is exactly what would lead to observing, you know, these kind of significant structure things in all the populations we study, because they all have their common ancestry. And so I guess I'm speculating that the indirect method is pointing to something else that's going on. It may not be something dealing with Neanderthals specifically. You know, the slide here where you estimate Neanderthal admixture using this model, this 10% value is very high. I don't want to go out on a limb saying there's actually 10% admixture, because chances are very unlikely that it was that high. But it could be that we're seeing a signal of the history of the modern humans that came into Europe just 10,000 years earlier when they were inside Africa. And that I think is quite plausible. And so that's our current working hypothesis of what's going on. It's just there's something else going on that we didn't know about in this very long time period when we don't have a clear sense from the fossil record.
Is there any reason to believe that anthropometric event was a single event from multiple groups following each other?
No. We don't know. I mean, obviously, there must have been multiple migrations. It's just a question of to what extent and what scale, whether they were very far separated in time. There's a major theory out there that there is an initial migration out of Africa that followed the coast. So let me actually go back to one of these maps. Okay, so here's what we know. We only know the first time we find fossils in a certain place. We don't actually know when people got there. So we find fossils in the Middle East 100,000 years ago. And then the next place we find fossils out of Africa is actually in Australia. We see evidence of human habitation 50 to 60,000 years ago. Okay, and we know that modern humans got into Europe after that. So it's not some simple process like here they are here and they just sort of wander wherever they go. There's something else going on. I mean, there can be barriers to gene flow. There could be cultural reasons why they don't go to certain places. Or there could be a long period of resistance or conflict between well-established Neanderthals all throughout this region and modern humans. Well, there are different hypotheses for what actually happened. All I can tell you is, you know, before modern humans got to Europe, they were already all over this area. We know this. And that's only just the first arrival. I mean, they could have actually gotten... I mean, that's only the oldest fossil, I mean. The first arrival could have been earlier. So the only major hypothesis out there that I think is reasonable is that there's an initial migration. It happened along the coast, and it went to Australia. And then there's a second migration tens of thousands of years later that led to European and mainland Asia colonization. And in theory, all this is testable if you have enough samples from all the parts of the world, but it's pretty hard to get those samples. Anyway, thank you.
Assuming you travel all along, so it doesn't have to worry about selection contributing to this equilibrium. Alternatively, are there ways of validating the model by looking at something else other than this equilibrium so that we can be reasonably confident that the model?
I don't know the answer to the second question. I think to the, I mean, this is sort of where, you know, it stops being science and it more is like art, that we just have data that consists of, you know, some humongous thing that we don't know how to interpret. And we think of things that we label like linkage disequilibrium as our way of trying to interpret this data. And it's entirely possible that there's another way of looking at data that would provide this independent sort of verification or testing of different models. And I think we're always limited by the types of things that people have proposed before, or the types of training that we have. And I don't know the answer as to whether there's something else like that. I can't answer a question about selection. Humans are very different from Drosophila. In particular, one of the aspects in which we're different is that our genomes are much longer, and the amount of functional DNA as a fraction of the total is much, much less than in Drosophila. So slightly over half of our genome consists of simple repeats, the elements that show up over and over and over again that are almost certainly non-functional. And there's an additional 30% of our genome that most people believe to be non-functional. And so not only is there a lot of non-functional DNA, but it turns out if you look at the parameters of population size and selection and recombination, it turns out the effect of selection on general patterns of DNA is less on average than in other species such as Drosophila that have a much more compact genome.
But there are these results, let's say from Jonathan Pritchard's lab or whatever, where he's identifying regions of the human genome that have this unusual haplotype structure that he interprets as, you know, ongoing selective sweeps or whatever. You don't see that in Drosophila a lot.
Except for like the pesticide resistance or whatever.
Yeah, like one gene.
Okay. That's true, but if you look at it that as a fraction of the genome, it's very small. And so I guess I'd say is the idea we take is we just look at a lot of regions, okay? And it's possible some of them are affected by selection, but I'd argue it's very few of them. And their signal is going to get swamped out by everything else.
You can just look, take your data and look in some sort of obviously non-functional line elements and see if you see the same patterns or different patterns. Like, can you bin the data in the cell
network? So we're data limited at the point that what I presented here comes from someone else's sequencing effort, which looked only at genic regions. So we're looking essentially at like introns and 5' and 3' flanking regions near to exons.
So that kind of invalidates the argument that most of DNA is not.
That's true, except that there are other reasons to believe most introns are essentially not. Most of the bases within introns are not functional and not strongly affected by linked selection. I will say, we've done the same analysis in another data set that is purely non-coding DNA, chosen to be far away from genes in single-copy non-coding regions. And it's expensive to gather that kind of data, but to the extent that we can, we find the same pattern. So
I was just going to say that it's not obvious to me that if there was introgression, it would be random regions of the genome. I mean, there's a good argument to be made that regions that have any kind of selective advantage would be more likely to be retained. I mean, that's the argument about FOXP2, for example. And so it's not actually clear that you would expect. I mean, if your migration, if there's introgression and you're looking conditional on the things that have survived to the present, it may well be things that were not neutral that survived.
That's Bruce's argument too, isn't it?
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
But it's also true that a little bit of selection doesn't necessarily invalidate the approach. Like you need a type of a certain type of selection that's going to produce signatures that you interpret.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the only thing that I would say is that, you know, all the other demographic model fitting and whatever is assuming neutrality, and so your ways of estimating things and your parameter estimates are going to be biased if, you know, if, for example, selection were rampant enough that it affects the frequency spectrum and you get a shift towards rare variants, well, the model is going to have to account for that in some way, and it may estimate population growth or some other factor that is not actually there to account for what's observed.
I thought we dealt with selection early in the week, otherwise it's getting very confusing.
Maybe again, a general question to this. Why is selection so much stronger in Drosophila? Like you offered the argument that the genome is more compact. Maybe it's just larger population sizes. Do we have more model species where we know about selection, or is it mainly the result of that?
Maybe you should answer that, Peter. You probably know better than I do.
Yeah, not a lot. I mean, there's this problem of species differ quite a bit, probably in population structure and mating livestock. So that's a problem. But in the types of patterns we were talking about last week have not been looked at in a lot of species size, maybe a couple of species, humans, Arabidopsis thaliana, which is a highly stealthing, highly geographically structured species, and yeast, which Guy was talking about. Mm-hmm.
In E. coli, but that's not clear what that means.
Right, and I know there seems to be this a sort of a pattern that Arabidopsis and humans, or Drosophila seems to be the outlier in this group. So you can interpret that as yeast, humans, and Arabidopsis being just very complicated, or the other way around.
or both.
Not enough species really to make a general.
Okay.
What is known about probability of recombination, how it is affected by local sequence divergence? And how would it affect your structure of LD?
I think Molly is best placed to answer that. Well, I think no one knows in humans.
In the case where your lineages are splitted for some time, it becomes quite an important factor potentially, right?
Yeah, I mean, there seems to be some evidence in yeast that, like, the greater the homology, the easier it is to recombine.
Well, in Drosophila, there is actually opposite evidence that recombination is happening much more frequently between divergent sequences than between ascending homozygotes.
There is?
Yep.
What's the evidence?
Direct evidence, Chuck's paper from 86.
I think in 2000, Chuck argued the opposite.
But it is actually experimental data.
Oh, but wait, this is the tip of the X story?
No, he's talking about something earlier. That's the 2000.
There's plenty of evidence in the other direction that there are these minimal efficiency processing segments where you have to have perfect homology for.
Well, what you call perfect homology, yeah.
Tens and hundreds of KB in order to resolve a holiday junction. And, I mean, that would not be a huge problem in humans given the heterozygosity, and I think actually the difference between Neanderthal and humans being only a couple, you know, 10 or 20% more than two humans, is that right?
Yeah.
It wouldn't really change much, but I mean, it might change very locally, but I don't think it would be a huge effect that it's Neanderthal and humans versus two humans.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the other thing I'd say is that humans would not be the best system to study that.
I'm not saying it's a system to study it. I'm merely asking how would it change the interpretation.
Uh-huh. Yeah, unknown. I suspect it's not a big deal. In the sense that, like, you know, our closest living relatives, chimpanzees, have more diversity than between humans and Neanderthals. So, and they seem to do okay.
Well,
that's true.